So this is Sarah Anglis. She is a musician and a composer, but she's also a roboticist. She builds lots of exciting instruments and works with a lot of electronic and robotic instruments. And what she's particularly interested in is a thing that she calls coupling, the idea that if we're no longer strumming a string, maybe we're doing something on a computer or making a gesture that makes that sound happen. How do people connect to the idea that you're making that music? Is that correct? Brilliant. Okay, so I'm going to hand over to Sarah now, who will talk about it much more eloquently and clearly than I did. Thank you.
Yeah, is that okay? Right. Oh, lovely to be here. And thanks to Nikki and everybody for inviting me. It's been a really lovely day. This is me in my natural habitat on the stage. I'm a performer. And here in this photo, you can see me on the theremin, which I'll say a bit about later. Stephen Hiscock, the percussionist behind me, and there on my left is Hugo, one of my robots. I often build robots to work with me on stage. Strictly speaking, when they're on stage, they're automata because they do my bidding, but I sometimes use them autonomously as well. But on stage, they're automata, but let's call them robots for today. And like many other composers, I create music through software as well, and sometimes it's entirely disembodied music, entirely through code, and there's nothing unusual in that. And when I'm doing a gig at the far end of the country, and it's up a really steep set of stairs, and I've got to schlep loads and loads of flight cases with all my kit in, I sometimes wonder, is it time to embrace the new and get rid of all this sort of 19th century gubbins and go entirely disembodied, go entirely into laptop performance. And believe me, it has been very tempting. But for some reason, I'm always, always drawn back to my machines. And I'm finding it interesting to unpick why, possibly because it might liberate me from this sort of bind that I have with them. Now, it's very interesting that this is called Bees in a Tin, this day, because I have actually been in a tin this week. I'm working on a submarine at the moment, installing a sound installation. And because of that, that's the inside of the submarine. That's what it looks like, 1947. Because of that, I'm actually unusually travelling light, so I've only brought one big thing with me, which is this here. This is the Ealing feeder, and I just thought I'd get the Ealing feeder going. It's one of the machines that I've built to work with me on stage, and sort of say a little bit about why I've gone down the machine route on stage, and a little bit about how it works. So, just going to set it off. It's just going to play a little something. And, you know, this is machine music. This is algorithmic music. It's not reading a score. I've just written a little algorithm, and the sort of music unfolds. It's very straightforward, this piece. So here it is. Can I talk? Am I getting feedback? Yeah, okay, here. If I keep right away from it for a sec. Yeah, so as you can see, it's a very simple mechanism. It's just some springs. Beaters on springs to give it a bit of compliance so it beats like an arm, and just loads and loads of servos and a bit of control software. And I build machines like this for a reason, because I'm a multi-instrumentalist and I want to have my hands free to do other stuff, like play my theremin or whatever. And I sort of came from a sort of folk music and classical music background, but very into electronics. And about 5 years ago, I went through my laptop-stricken phase, as I call it, and I started going out, putting laptop music on behind my theremin, and everybody went to the bar. And I realised that possibly my act was sort of missing something. And then when I started to build physical machines to accompany me, to do my... Basically, this is just a loop machine. I started to find lots of wonderful things out that... You're using the real world. You're not modelling the real world. As Rodney Brooks said, the world is its own best model. And you're getting all sorts of stuff for free here, getting all sorts of stuff. Like you're saying, do less. You don't have to do much here. You don't have to model sympathetic resonance, because they are resonating against each other. And you don't have to model sort of wonkiness, because it's a machine. So it is shonky and it is wonky. And yet it can still do things that a human can't do. Like at the moment, it's playing a 5-against-7 rhythm. Should I put the... I'll stop talking for a second. So... thanks, yeah. I'll just stop those. So yeah, so that's the Ealing Feeder, and it's a gigging instrument. It's got gaffer tape all over it because it does actually gig with me. And as I say, I swiftly discovered that I was onto something when I made physical machines and put them on stage instead of the laptop. The audience paid attention. This is such a simple device. A bit like you're saying about the typewriter being a sort of fairly straightforward device that's been really worked and evolved and everybody sort of knows how it works. But we're starved of this stuff in the era of Nintendo, when, you know, our world is replete with exquisite computer graphics. We don't see physical moving things very often. And I've noticed that they become the thing that people remember on the stage more than they remember me. Especially when I go out with my sort of figurative robots. And again, like you're saying, do less. I was saying earlier, do less. He's a 1930s ventriloquist dummy. It's beautifully designed. So I just roboticized him. And he gives my samples, my spoken samples, a physical instantiation on stage. So, you know, he's on stage with me and he moves around. And anytime there's any spoken stuff, it comes from Hugo. And talking about when you make things physical, you get a lot for free because you're situating things in the world. One thing you get from free is the world itself, and the world's got people in it. So when they see Hugo, he is a dumb machine. All he does is, I've just written a little algorithm that when he hears speech, he moves his mouth in response to what he's hearing, so it looks realistic. But because of that, and because he moves in the old ventriloquist dummy way, you know, his eyes move and his head moves, people credit him with intelligence that he doesn't have, and they'll say, oh, Hugo's a bit this today, and Hugo's a bit that today. And people are quite fearful of him as well. And he didn't come with me today because he hasn't got sea legs. But well, we were talking about play earlier and about Hugo and the idea that when you put something in the world, you get, you know, instead of having it on a screen, sort of trapped inside a screen, you get the world as it was for free, and you get the intelligence in the world for free. A beautiful example of this is the work of Edward Anatovitz. I don't know if you're familiar with the Sensor from 1967. Incredibly simple idea, but beautifully executed. This is it. It just did two things. It was beautifully designed. It had an animal-like sort of form. And it just had a sort of radar. He called it radar, but it was a bit like a proximity detector, analog proximity detector. And it had a sound detector. So what it did is it approached sounds and it approached moving things. But if there was a sudden sound or a sudden movement, it recoiled. That's all it did. It just had an approach recoil mechanism. And yet, people found it very, very lifelike because it was situated in the world. And what were they doing? They were playing around it. They were responding to it. It was merely reflecting their own intelligence back at them. But they started to credit the Sensor with all sorts of intelligences. And what I love about the Sensor, this is 1967, people wrote papers on it, psychologists. In the mornings, because it was attracted to sound, it would be curled up listening to the sound of its own motors. And then when the cleaner came in, it would go. And so like it was a phenomenon, a beautiful, beautiful piece of engineering. And it still is to this day. Now, my own machines have gone through many, many iterations. And I don't beat myself up about that, because they are gigging instruments. They have to go out on stage with me and they have to work. And there's a certain, I always think of it a bit like, I think people like Jeopardy. I think people like machines on stage because they offer Jeopardy that you don't get when you go out with the laptop. There's a hell of a lot of Jeopardy going out with a laptop, but people don't see it, but they do with this. And there is genuine Jeopardy, and that's why I've sort of like, here's the bells, the original instantiation of the bells. Yeah, there's genuine Jeopardy because you're sort of, and I'm always sort of refining and refining, and this is how the bells started out on an old shop fitting that I found in a skip. But I don't beat myself up about the fact that I never quite get it right, that I'm always going out with prototypes and there's always something that's going to go wrong, because I think the audience love that. It feels like watching a tightrope walker. They really love that, and is it going to get through the set? And I kind of milk that a bit. You'll notice that I don't cover up mechanisms because I'm very keen. It's very interesting what you're saying, Henry, about hiding the mechanism. I do the opposite. I show the mechanism because I want people to, A, because I want people to see the engineering, but also because I think it adds to the sense of danger because you don't see mechanisms and it's usually a sign that something's about to go wrong. And of course, you know, we do sort of have rather high standards, like in music. We forget, like you're saying about the Romans, we forget that the instruments that we normally get to see have had many, many iterations, many, many generations have worked on them and evolved their design. And it really is a sort of a form of evolution of musical instrument design where humans have been the selectors. And the selection pressure is very interesting. You know, if you take an instrument like the serpent, what a brilliant idea. It was a very, very effective way to make a long instrument that you could reach. But that went out of fashion, and you have to ask yourself why. And this one, the sort of things that just sort of die for no apparent reason. I love this. This is a piano with, I don't know if you can see the two pedals, sort of knee pedals. They were called the Nag's Head pedals. And it lifted the lid up and down to get a sort of wah-wah effect. That died. Brilliant idea. But then some things died for very good reason, like the giraffe piano. Died for many reasons, one of which is you couldn't get it in most people's houses. But it was very, very popular in about 1810, 1820. And it was also, for interface design, it's very interesting because it was genuinely the piano with all the bells and the whistles. It really did have pretty much bells and whistles inside it. Well, actually, what it did have, it had about five pedals, and it had these, they're called Janissary bells. So when you played Turkish music, which was very fashionable, you could get the bells going, and it had bits of paper, or sometimes leather, but usually paper, that went between the hammers and the strings. And the idea there was that it made a sort of buzzing sound, which they called a bassoon pedal. And that completely died a death. And then, I don't know, 1950s, John Cage came along and Music for a Prepared Piano was written. And it was really reinventing many of the ideas that were already inside things like the giraffe piano. And in fact, I always say to people, when somebody does a website interface that's got too many bells and whistles, they say, oh, that's terrible. I say, no, it's a giraffe piano. So always remember that. But what's interesting, yes, is that before the electronic age, if you wanted to make a sound, you had to physically embody it. So, you know, if you wanted bass, you had to make an instrument that was long and such like. And now, when we're on stage, it's wonderful. We can do all this stuff. We're sort of liberated. We're sort of decoupled, as it were, from this sort of necessity to make big things for low notes and small things for high notes. But that has many problems. If you take the instrument that I play, for example, the theremin, which is in itself quite old, 1919 it was invented. For those of you who haven't seen a theremin, sorry I couldn't bring one on the via submarine today, two aerials, and I stand in front of it and I move my hands nearer and further the aerial. And there's a proximity effect, so I use that sort of pitch up, pitch down. Now, to me, when I'm playing that, I like to think that the audience are paying attention, A, because you don't see them very often, and to me, because it's blindingly obvious. There's a very, very close coupling between I'm moving my hand towards the aerial, the pitch slid up. I move my hand away, the pitch slipped down. And I also don't use it to control pitch. I use it to control samples and video speeds and all of those things. So I was going around quite happily thinking, yeah, people get this. And then I started to get feedback from the audience, and it was chilling and fascinating. These are some of the things that were said to me. You're whistling. You've done that my favourite one. You're working the lights. Somebody said, no, I know what you were doing tonight. You were working the lights, weren't you? And they obviously thought the music was going on and I was just working the lights. And I found this very interesting because it really sort of brought home to me that when I'm on stage, I can't just perform with an exotic musical interface, a physical device, and expect people to know what I'm doing. I have to sort of introduce it gradually. So if you see me play the theremin, I always tune up in front of the audience. I don't need to tune up in front of the audience, but I do that because it's my sort of sly way of introducing them to the interface. And as I perform, I always try to sort of think of it as like a rope where I'll do a very simple action on the theremin and they get the woo up, and then I do another one, and then I'll make it more complicated, make it more complicated. And it's this sort of sense of she did this, and then this happened in response. She did an embellishment of that, and then this happened in response. And it's so then it sort of feels like there's a sort of physical rope that's sort of attaching. We're sort of like pulling the audience along with me, and we're all understanding what the game is, and we're all in it together. And I think this is very important and very significant, and it's something that's incredibly hard to do if you're performing behind a laptop, because they don't see the strings, so how can they get what your intentions are, how your actions are relating to the sound? Because relating actions to sound is a very powerful thing, and when you get it right, well, it's intoxicating. I don't know if you've ever been to a gig where you're in the room and the performance is going really well and the audience are really into it, and then the room becomes electric. It's like a collective fever. It's sort of been called by psychologists an emotional contagion. And I think that's the wonderful thing about music. It's sort of, there's an emotional contagion between the performer and the audience. But there's also an emotional contagion that's gone through time, because the person that wrote the music has embodied their emotion in the music, and then you're sort of liberating it. And I find that absolutely fascinating. And I'm from a Welsh family on my mother's side. And we have this word called hoyle, which describes it beautifully, which is, this is probably somebody experiencing hoyle. Hoyle is it's a sort of shared feeling that you get in a room where you're all experiencing an intense emotion together through music. And I think what's so fascinating about hoyle is that what we're starting to learn about this contagion in sort of neuroscience. So it's only about 2009, or was it 2010, that a mechanism was discovered for this emotional contagion, which of course is the mirror neuron, which is the idea that when you see somebody making an action, neurons in your mind fire as though you are performing that action yourself. So observation and action are very, very closely linked. And so it's not surprising that if you're seeing a performer on stage making certain movements, that that's going to elicit certain feelings in you. And as I say, the feeling that you get from music when it's just right, when you get this feeling that descends on the room, is, it has sort of been noted throughout time. I mean, in Renaissance culture, we have this idea about, you know, the Renaissance music literature, about the idea of grace. And this is the idea that if you get sprezzatura, which is sort of derring do, and technique, absolutely imperfect harmony, then grace is this thing that sort of descends into the room and sort of captivates everyone. And it's that thing that sort of binds everyone together. And it's an emergent phenomenon, and you kind of know it if you feel it. And as I say, music is so intoxicating. I mean, just an example of how intoxicating music is, I often think about, like, extreme metal. I've been asking people about extreme musical experiences recently. And if you take something like, I never know if you say Sun or Sun-O, but they're an extreme metal group anyway. Their whole idea is that this is their warning to the front of house staff. their whole thing is that they make palpable noise. So just get this, you go to a gig and you vie to get the best seats, which are usually the ones nearest the speakers. You vie to hear music that destroys your hearing as you are listening to it. That is how important the experience is to you. And it's a palpable experience. You know, it's a multimodal thing. It's not just about the sound. It's about the fog and all of this. And it's about, you know, your trousers flapping. And I often say to people, isn't it weird that we do that with music? Because you don't hear that about light shows. Yeah, I went to this light show. Yeah, I can't see a thing. I mean, I've done my eyes in, but oh God, it's great. I'm going back next week. And I think that's what says all you need to know about the sort of extreme power of music. And as I say, it's nothing new. If you look at organ pipes in some of the biggest cathedrals, they may not be of the sort of same power levels as some of these extreme metal groups, but they're creating infrasound, very, very extreme bass sound that's sort of used to sort of put a sense of dread in the music. And I've asked sort of lots of organ builders about those pipes, and some have said it's a very expensive way to make a draft. And some have said, you don't hear the sound, it's so low, you just kind of feel it, but it's like it sort of adds the sort of sense of awe to the music. So, to me, it's an interesting thing, this feeling that you get from music when it's just right. And you could think of it as the sublime, and the sublime is an interesting idea, which is a sort of intense, exhilarating feel of connectedness that with it, because this is like a sublime experience here, that with it has a sort of certain sense of danger, a sort of a certain awareness of your own annihilation, which obviously you do when you go to hear an extreme metal group. And I think that if you can capture a bit of that in whatever way, you can create a very memorable experience. And so this is the bit of the challenge, isn't it, for the laptop performer, because, and they're also offering a challenge to us, because you think, well, if there's no sort of physical sense of the performer's intention, if the only sense you have of the performer's intention is through what you're hearing, are they making the job very hard for themselves? Or is there something that I can unlock in laptop performance that I haven't found? And when I think about the mirror neuron research, I find that interesting, and about the whole idea of a collective experience and emotional contagion, because music offers a sort of confounding examples. Because what about when you're at home on your own sobbing to a record that's sort of completely disembodied? When I talk about, how am I doing for time, by the way? Oh, right, that's good, right. So when I talk about getting something for free when you put things in the world, I think the other thing you get for free is a sense of what I'd call the uncanny. So here's an example of something that I built. It's very, very simple. That's kind of given me something free. It's very simple. It's a handbag that I've motorized so it follows my heartbeat. And of course, there is something very odd about it. And again, I could make an animated thing. Could I could make a GIF or whatever you'd call it? These, you know, like, whatever. I could make a thing that did that on the screen, and I bet you it wouldn't have quite the same sort of unsettling experience, because it's an object that's not doing what it's supposed to do. And when I talk about the uncanny, you might be thinking of the uncanny valley hypothesis. I'm sure many of you know about the. I mean, do you all know about the uncanny valley hypothesis? Okay, well, I'll very, very briefly. This is a very contentious idea in robotics, which is about how we feel about human-like objects. So it goes like this, you know, that we like them. We like things like this doll here because they're like us, and we feel familiar and we feel empathy and we like them. But if objects get a little bit too human-like, something strange starts to happen. We start to find them very disturbing, as you may feel disturbed by this doll right now. And this sort of plummeting our empathy, this sort of feeling of feeling unsettled by it, is called the uncanny valley hypothesis. And it is just a hypothesis because nobody knows how to fathom it. You know, what makes one object more human than another? You know, what are the variables? Is it about the size of the eyes? Is it about the relative dimensions? Is it about the skin texture? So it's a bit of a sort of I'd say it's sort of like 10% science, 90% folk wisdom, but it's an interesting one to sort of work with. But I'm interested in the more sort of venerable idea of the uncanny, das Unheimliche, which is about familiar objects taking on a strange cast, which that bag does for real, and it's the sort of visceral fear that you get when you see an object that shouldn't be doing what it does moving in the world like that handbag does. And there's nothing more uncanny than a doppelganger that speaks. And Hugo here, I would say that he's quite an uncanny creature, as in people phone me up to ask if he's going to be at the gig because they don't like to turn up if he's there. Some people are quite phobic of him. But I sort of found that I'd sort of got to this point where I'd gone on this trajectory where it was like, oh, you know, 2005, oh, I'm going to go out with my laptop. Oh, everybody's gone to the bar. I need to rethink. And I started building things and then found that I was getting somewhere. But I'd sort of painted myself into a corner because what was happening was I was being attracted to objects like Hugo and bells that have a certain sort of continuity with performances of the past. And it was starting to look, and I don't mean this in a sort of daft way, it was starting to feel like a bit of an end of the pier show. It was like an aesthetic that I love, that sort of slightly dilapidated, again, sort of, is it going to get through the show sort of type aesthetic. But it was a very particular aesthetic, and I was finding I was getting myself a bit stuck. And I thought, I know what I'm attracted to. I'm attracted to this idea of uncanniness, like objects having human agency. So very brief, because I haven't got long. I've started on a new project, which is trying to create uncanny objects that aren't figurative. It's very, very early work, so I haven't got much to show. But, so I'm working at the Pervasive Media Studio in Bristol, and I've been also doing some work in a motion capture studio, AIR, in Falmouth. It's an Arts Council-funded project. And what I'm trying to do is take objects and put human motion into them that suggests something about the objects. So my handbag, if you like, was a very sort of cheap and cheerful example of that, because it was a handbag that was blood red, ox blood red handbag, which I deliberately chose. And it was my heartbeat, and the bag was about the same age as me. And so it was that whole thing of like, my heart's been doing that all these years and this bag's doing it. And I just like the sort of association between the two. So I was thinking, well, can I take that idea further? And so I've been trying to find very simple objects and very simple movements that I can take that I might possibly work with on the stage that have a sense of the uncanny. So that sort of have some sort of sense of human agency. So an example, very simple one, in the motion capture studios, been recording brushing hair. And then what I'm going to do is, using very simple robotics, take the motion of the hairbrush, remove the person, remove any robot-y arm thing that looks like it's a mimetic robot arm, and just have the hairbrush using robotics, very simple robotics, moving through space. And of course, as a hairbrush moves through space, it's doing two things, isn't it? It's carving out the person through negative space, and it's telling you about the intentions of the person and the mood of the person and possibly the age of the person. It's telling you an awful lot because it's got the human agency embedded in it. And similarly, I'm actually at the moment having my first stab at making one of these things. It's actually some bowls. So I recorded myself eating some soup. And then the idea is I'm going to record some other people eating soup. And it'll just be like a disembodied meal. And it'll just be these little bowls percussing away. And I like that because it's a percussive thing. And it's also a visual thing. And they'll just be moving as though people are eating. So just very, very briefly, because we haven't got long. This is me in the Motion Capture Labs with my some markers on. And it's that we use to capture my emotion. I haven't got time to show you the data, but if anyone's interested, I've got it on the computer now. I can run a bit of it. But of course, this is like the Rolls Royce of how to do motion capture. And now I'm trying to do kind of very simple motion capture and going with the do less philosophy, which I'm completely into. Everything, use Kinect, use this, use that. But of course, I'm not trying to do anything as complex as a whole human body. I'm just trying to measure what the brush is doing, or I'm just trying to measure what the bowl is doing. So I'm just trying to use really simple things like IMUs and a little bit of motion capture, sort of visual motion capture, you know, using stuff like that, optical flow and things like that, just to capture what the objects are doing. So that's the next stage. So just to sort of sum up, I haven't given up on laptop performance by any means, but I do think it's offering a challenge for people like me who want to have an act that feels that it lives in the world. And I think I need to find something that is really going to compete with the sort of sheer joy of having sort of objects in the world that don't need to be modelled because they just are, and they just are themselves. And it's a very interesting time for me because I think about some of the sort of best laptop performers that are around, people like Holly Herndon. I think, well, maybe there is a sort of certain uncanniness that they have. Maybe they've offloaded it from physical objects into the nature of their act, where they're presenting their voice, for example, in unexpected ways. But it doesn't quite convince me. And I'm still looking for the laptop performance that can compete in the physical world. And of course, the big sort of irony with music, of course, is the most uncanny thing that ever happened was sound recording, where sound became completely disembodied, because then, for the first time ever in 1877, when people first heard recorded sound, they were hearing a disembodied voice for the first time, and the voice was a doppelganger of the original, a sort of double of the original. And they found that incredibly uncanny, to the point where they sort of even mused about the oddness of hearing voices of people that had died. And in fact, one of the very earliest sort of sound transmission experiments was the Invisible Girl. And she was sold, you know, people would queue up to go and visit her in sort of 1804. And it was just sort of like a very primitive sort of mechanical telephone in Piccadilly. People would go to hear this woman, and she was sort of sold as an aeromancer, a sort of invisible sage that was in the air. And so I think what's promising about this is that sound has a way, and music has a way, to sort of defy your sort of assumptions. And I think what's also promising, when I think about the fact that I've now got a real challenge, because I've got to go from the stage to turning my music into something on a record, is that I have to remember how wonderful it is to have physical things in the world. So as I'm producing my record, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, download culture, streaming culture, I haven't got an earthly of making even ends meet with an album. I'm thinking, yes, but wait a minute, what was that? All that stuff I learned on stage about how important it is to have different forms of physicality in your music. You know, music's about more than listening. It's about what you see and what you think you can reach out and touch. Well, of course, music is also, when you listen to it, it's about more than listening. It's more, much, much more than a bunch of MP3 files. And if you don't believe me, just think about the DJ we had on earlier and how you can remember the smell of the gatefold sleeve of your favourite albums. And so that's what I'm trying to do now, is sort of apply some of these principles into the recorded realm as well as onto the stage. So I hope that's useful and I hope that's interesting. And it's been a lovely day. Thank you.